Businesses have a responsibility throughout their entire value chains to respect human rights. If you can apply pressure at the top of the supply chain strategically, then you can achieve change at the bottom.
You are listening to Radio Atticus,
your national program on the law in the name of social justice.
This is obviously a live issue, and we need to start to talk about how we might regulate it here so that we aren't outsourcing our problems.
People are curious. They look at you and they want to know your story.
Radio Atticus, more than the vibe. Hello and welcome to your national program on the law and justice and how it impacts your daily lives. Anna Marie Reyes.
Hi, I'm Sophia Carvajal. I'm joining Anna Marie on your favourite legal broadcast.
In this program, we look into the Australasian Law Teachers Association conference recently held in South Australia with a prominent panel called First Kill All the Lawyers, and the latest update on the death of the Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo. It's not often you witness the legal fraternity throwing the gauntlet and accepting change is in the offing. After all, it's considered as one of the most predictable and secure professional sector. Many believe if you complete a legal degree, you're set for life and will get a decent pay rise. But at the Australasian Law Teachers Association conference held in South Australia, the complete opposite happened. Justices of the High Court, lawyers, teachers of law, legal students and a few journalists like myself started to nod our heads in unison that the law of the land is on the line. Democracy is under threat, justices are judged in the media, legal jobs are disappearing while student numbers are on the rise, and lawyers are no longer expected to be in courthouses as much as doing problem solving online or settling out of court. The tide of change is so big that after almost a week of deep stocktaking, the final panel was called First Let's Kill All the Lawyers. In the first part of this series, Should We Really Kill All the Lawyers?, we hear the voice of the Honourable Justice John Mansfield, AMQC. But before that, though, here's an explanation of what killing the lawyers is really all about, explained by the Honourable Robin Layton, AOQC.
So, as many of you would know, the proposition derives from Shakespeare's play, Henry VI. And for those of you that are into finite detail, part 2, act 4, scene 2, line 73. So just a little of background there. Firstly, the actual line was, the first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. So the characters involved in the scene sound like those from a Damon Runyon short story. So the line was said by the character called Dick the Butcher, and he is one of the members of the gang led by Jack Cade. Jack Cade was historically a true character, and he led a rebellion at the time of Henry VI against corruption and the abuse of power. Now, that was sort of a bit of an umbrella because there were a whole lot of sideline issues that clearly he was very interested in. Not the least was promoting himself. So in Shakespeare's play, Jack Cade is portrayed as a man who has noble blood and he has excessive delusions of grandeur. And while talking up equality, at the same time he insists on being treated as a king. Have we ever heard that story before somewhere else? And those who don't agree with him are killed. So Dick the Butcher, he's the second in charge, and he loves the idea of anarchy, and he also loves the idea of killing, and his name suggests it all. There's another character, Smith the Weaver. He joins Cade's rebellion and goes along with Cade, in particular on the condemnation of people who are literate. But in spite of that, these two characters, Dick and Smith, are not impressed with Cade's claims of noble blood. So this is the precise thing. Cade makes a series of very vain assertions, and both Dick and Smith come in with a side. So they're not saying it to him, they're saying it to the audience. And gradually, Cade builds up to an absolute orchestra, raising his levels higher and higher and higher, until he comes up with what he regards as the utopia of where he wants to go. So this is what he, in fact, says. This is Jack. "Be brave, then, for your captain is brave and vows reformation. There shall be in England 7 halfpenny loaves for sold for a penny. The 3-hooped pot shall be 10 hoops, and I will make it a felony to drink small beer. All of the realm shall be in common, and in Cheapside shall my palfrey go to grass. And when I am king, as king I will be," and this is where Dick and Smith go, "Hail to your majesty." And he says, "I thank you, good people. There shall be no money. All shall eat and drink on my score, and I will apparel them all in one livery, and they may agree like brothers and worship me their lord." Dick says, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." Jack says, "Nay, that I mean to do." So that is the context of it all. And the wonderful thing is that scholars have had multiple interpretations of that. And interpretations are various. And is it simply, for example, a lawyer-bashing joke to express commonly held views, negative views about lawyers being arrogant, greedy, speaking arcane language, etc., remembering that lawyers would have been in the audience when this was being played because they did like to go to Shakespearean plays? Was it an ironic joke? And it was ironically suggested by Dick to Cade for inclusion as part of his vision. Or was it a statement suggesting that lawyers needed to be killed because they would otherwise impede the rebellion, and it was a favourable reflection on lawyers? So let's see what our wonderful speaker is going to say about that and also the future of law.
And now let's hear from the Honourable Justice John Mansfield and whether he thinks, yes, lawyers should be killed. Justice Mansfield was appointed to the Federal Court of Australia in September 1996 and retired in 2016. He starts his speech by saying that the character Jack Cade was simply a rebel. So to him, the killing of lawyers is actually representing Jack's dislike against lawyers because they represent the rule of law, which Jack disagrees with.
I prefer the interpretation that says, as most people I think say, Jack Cade was a rabble, or his mob was a rabble. He was trying to upset the existing structure of government. He came in and wanted to kill all the lawyers because they represented the means by which the rule of law might be insisted upon. And in fact, his rebellion was pretty short because people realised, according to Shakespeare at least, that the rule of Henry V and then Henry VI was something more pleasant than having Jack Cade ruling as a tyrant. So we're talking about the role of lawyers, the role of law teachers, and I want to emphasise that I'm going to talk about teaching law rather than writing academic law. I know that when I was a law student, the role of law teachers was essentially teaching. There wasn't that huge emphasis on publications, which you now have. I'm not sure I would enjoy that as much as I suspect many of you do, but it is a great challenge to do the balance. I'm not going to talk about the balance. I really want to talk about law teaching. I would think that it's never been a more exciting time to be a law teacher.
Justice Mansfield speaks of an easier time in the 1960s to enter the legal profession with no strict pre-qualifications.
It was in a sense, an idealistic and innocent time. There were no quotas to get into law schools. There were relatively few law schools. We were still suffering the consequences of the loss of people, men mainly, the loss of people during World War II, so that the opportunities to get into the legal profession were ample. None of us worried much about getting jobs. there are enough lawyers practicing to train us in practical legal training. So we all did articles rather than had a postgraduate practical legal training course. I think my first year intake was about 60 for the whole of South Australia. When I was the president of the Law Council in the early 1990s, we had about 30,000 lawyers practising, and now there are about 60,000. So the accumulation of lawyers is immense. We knew all our teachers by name. Many of them became friends, and some of them still are friends, so that the interaction between law students and law teachers was very much different from the opportunities which you have now with huge numbers of classes. In fact, I remember one of our law teachers, who was a very great cricket fan, used to have his seminars or tutorials on the hill at Adelaide Oval during the Sheffield Shield games. So it was seven or eight people go down and watch the cricket and have a bit of a chat about his teaching. So that was a different sort of environment from which we now operate.
He also speaks of learning law at a time when the Vietnam War was taking place while apartheid was raging in Africa. In Australia, it was also a time when legal assistance for Indigenous Australians didn't exist. So what made it all so different now? Justice Mansfield explains.
Social conscience in relation to the operation of the law was really relatively incipient. My recollection is that we were confronted principally in the late 60s, early 70s by apartheid, because there was a South African team, a rugby team, I think, coming to play in Australia, and there was a great deal of angst about that, so there was protest against that. We were confronted by the Vietnam War. Many of the people in Australia regarded that as inappropriate, and I'm not going to comment on my other, but presented real issues of conscience. We were confronted by the ballot, where there was compulsory conscription on a ballot basis, and that itself presented some challenges. And the third thing, which was really, I think, very incipient and now very important, is the status of Indigenous Australians. It was only in the early 1970s that the legal profession, I think, started to organise itself to recognise the problem of Indigenous Australians, both in the criminal law system and then more widely in the social system of Australia. So that phenomenon was evolving, and there were lawyers like Robin, much more so than I, who started things like the Legal Assistance Scheme for Indigenous Australians. Started largely in Alice Springs, perhaps because there were more challenges there, but those things were just evolving. That was a very innocent time, and it was just the time when conscience, in a sense, was becoming part of the awareness of lawyers in a more philosophical and principled sense than just applying the law as it then was.
One of the prominent changes, he says, is what he calls the death of democracy.
We in Australia are part of the democratic philosophy, but there are now serious academic publications about the death of democracy. Mm. So the form of government itself is now a matter of question. You've seen that to a degree evolving over the last 10 or 20 years, and perhaps illustrated, and I don't use this particularly as pejoratively, but by the present President of the United States, whose perception of the rule of law, the balance of legislative, executive and judicial, is very unsophisticated. 20 years ago, I think, well, not a bit longer, Bjelke Petersen in Queensland had the same problem. He was asked during an interview about something he was complaining about. What do you say about the rule of law? Oh, well, very, very important. Well, what is it? Oh, very important. He couldn't answer because he didn't have any idea at all, because he was, in a sense, a tyrannical, that is, in a sense of saying, I rule, I'm the government, I'm the Premier of Queensland, let's just forget about the rest. So that sort of social awareness and social acceptance of a structure of society has changed. At least it's being challenged.
And finally, he speaks of the increased unfairness of society.
We have another challenge. It's something which is underlying democracy. That is the fairness of the society. And you might think, and there's some literature also which says this about the fairness of society, that since the 1980s, when the globalisation of society has happened and the internationalisation of commerce and communications whoppingly increased, that the fairness of society has itself changed. We know, you know, everyone here knows, that we now have more or less a permanent group that's a part of our society who are stuck in an unemployed or underemployment situation, which is generational. That's a new thing. Those sort of changes are happening, and the statistics, if you want to look at them, are pretty clear. It was said that globalisation would increase the wealth of the world, particularly a world with a dramatically increasing population. And it has, statistically, it is said to have increased the wealth of the world by about 15% over the last 20 or 30 years. When you think about the wealth of the world, that's a huge amount of money. But what hasn't happened is that the wealth of the world has been shared, because that 15 or 20% is stuck in the top 10% of the community. That's a challenge to our society. And if you as law teachers are teaching law, you have to present to your students these sort of social realities so that the law works within a structure like that, and they can make decisions about how the law should operate in that environment. So whatever you're teaching something which is evolving as a part of the process of maintaining, or if you want to, changing the society, either the way it's governed, the government structure, or the way in which the government structure operates.
The voice of the Honourable Justice John Mansfield, AMQC, in the first part of the series, Should We Really First Kill All the Lawyers? You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER.
Well-pressed and well-dressed, you can't see any of that though, because this is radio.
2SER.com. So what's happening this week?
Have you ever seen laser beams in the sky?
What were you thinking?
I find an opportunity to lick Richard Wilkins.
Okay.
Interviews and discussions and all sorts of interesting things. 107.3.
2SER.
Being injured in an accident can have a real impact on you financially. Injuries can mean time off work, medical bills and other expenses. But you might actually be entitled to compensation to cover these expenses. If you're unsure, call a specialist injury lawyer and ask. Law Partners is Australia's largest specialist personal injury firm, and it costs nothing to call their local office to get some advice. Call Law Partners on 133 529. Or visit lawpartners.com.au.
2SER sponsors.
2SER 107.3. And this week we're probing the dark recesses of the mind.
Oogum boogum.
Very scary.
Did you wet yourself?
It could happen to you.
Stick around even if that scene does disturb you too much.
My mind has just been blown.
2SER.com.
And the latest update on the death of the Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo.
Nobel Peace Prize laureate and Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo has died from cancer at the age of 61 on July 14. Mr. Xiaobo was diagnosed with terminal liver cancer in May this year, and the human rights activist died in a Chinese hospital. Critics say that the Chinese government impeded his treatment by declaring him unfit for travel overseas, despite international medical practitioners giving him the all clear for travel. Mr. Xiaobo was an activist from the time of the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989 up until the present day. He is most known for the Charter 08 Manifesto, which demanded the Chinese government reconsider reforming the system to pave a way for democracy. We revisit an interview from Adrian Walton recently, who spoke to Dr. Pinchamon Yeofatong, Project Director at the Australian Human Rights Centre, for an insight into Mr. Xiaobo's activism over his lifetime and his political influence on the world stage.
Dr. Pitchamon, good morning.
Good
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Now, let's start off. Why was Liu jailed?
Well, basically, Liu Xiaobo is one of the most well-known political human rights activists in China. And basically what he'd done, I mean, he has a very long record of engaging in human rights activism in the country ever since the Tiananmen in 1989. But he was jailed basically because of his involvement in releasing this manifesto known as Charter 08, which basically demanded that the Chinese government reconsider its current governance system and aim towards reforming the system in order to pave the way for basically a democracy.
Right. And that's essentially got him. Liu jailed was the release of this manifesto?
Yes, that's right. Because, I mean, Liu has been on the Chinese government's kind of watch list for a very long time. Everyone knows that he's a prominent dissident voice. And so with the release of this manifesto, it was like the final hay that basically led to his jail.
Right. How do things like that go down in China? I mean, we hear so much about human rights in China. Something like this wouldn't have gone down too well, I dare say?
Well, I mean, to be honest, if you ask people in China, even right now after his release from jail, it's surprising that many people actually don't know about Liu that much.
Right.
If you ask the average Chinese citizen, they probably know very little about what has gone on ever since him being put in jail in 2008. And this basically represents the situation in China where you have, you know, a lot of censorship of the state media and censorship of what people actually get fed in terms of information. However, you know, that it is the case that, again, as I said, he is prominent not just because he's well known outside of China, but because there are pockets of opposition within China that have been trying to really build up his reputation, his credibility, but also to advocate on his behalf ever since he's been in jail.
Right. Now, his release has come recently. Is that just due to his illness, or are they sort of being a bit lenient on Liu?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because there is some speculation that perhaps his release is a positive development for China, in the sense that they might be demonstrating some degree of lenience. However, it seems to be more the case that they're releasing him on medical grounds, mm-hmm. because he is terminally ill. And if anything, the Chinese government probably does not want a Nobel Prize, Peace Prize laureate dying behind bars.
Mm. Do they recognize the Nobel Prize at all, the Chinese government?
Well, if you consider their negative recognition of his of the Nobel Prize, then yes. I mean, when he was awarded it back in 2010, that caused a lot of negative publicity for the Nobel Peace Prize in China. You, of course, had Chinese government officials coming out and saying that, you know, Norway, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee, was entirely wrong in awarding this prestigious prize to a Chinese prisoner, as they put it. And at the same time, you might also recall that there were other groups in China trying to set up an alternative to the Nobel Peace Prize, which was known then as the Confucian Peace Prize. So it was definitely publicized, but perhaps not in as a positive a light as in outside of China.
Right. Now, has China's newly found openness with their international communities affected their human rights policy at all, do you think?
Well, over the years, it has been the case that China has improved in terms of being more tolerant, I suppose, of political dissent. Having said that, Xi Jinping, ever since he's come into power, as many human rights organizations have noted, the government has engaged in a crackdown of civil society activity, especially in the human rights realm. And so for that reason, you see a fairly paradoxical situation where, on the one hand, China has been opening up very quickly and aggressively to the outside world, and yet on human rights issues, it remains quite guarded in its attitude to external criticism, especially from Western countries like the U.S.
Mm. Do we know of many current sort of prisoners that are political prisoners or human rights prisoners as such?
Well, it's estimated that there are at least 1,300 wow. human rights political prisoners in China, although the number is probably even higher. We don't know all of the cases, of course, because this is treated as, you know, state secrets. Having said that, most recently, only in July 2015, there was this major crackdown on human rights activists. Just early in May 2017, so a couple of months ago, a statement was, for instance, released by one prominent human rights lawyer by the name of Xie Yang, who had been jailed ever since July 2015 for his work. And he'd come out in May 2017 with a statement saying that he accepts that he has been trying to subvert state power and the like. So it's a situation where we do know that there are these people being put into jail, but the issue is that we don't really know what's happening to them in jail or in custody, and their fate in many cases is also quite unclear.
Mm. And on the international stage, do we think that things are changing as far as China's actions, China's reactions to people, this dissent that you say, that is coming out of their own people?
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's internationally, I suppose this is the upside of having a very active social media in China, despite the great firewall, as people call it. It's still possible to share information on these issues through the use of, you know, ingenuous slangs and other puns in order to get message across on human rights activism and dissent. But as I also said earlier, it's a tricky situation where people who do share such information, they also are put at risk. And regardless of social media, it remains quite difficult to circumvent the Great Firewall as well. So in one sense, having that kind of heightened international awareness of these issues in China, whilst very promising, it's also still difficult to see that level of awareness being filtered down in Chinese society at the moment.
Mm. Dr. Pichamon, thank you for your time and joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Pichamon Yeofatong, Project Director at the Australian Human Rights Centre, talking to Adrian Walton about the recent death of Chinese political activist Mr. Liu Xiaobo.
That story produced by Samuel Yang and narrated by Peter Lewin on the update on the Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo.
I'm Michael Kirby, and you are listening to Radio Atticus. Radio Atticus is part of the Community Radio Network. I was formerly a Justice of the High Court of Australia with no time to listen to this, but now I sit glued to Radio Atticus.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
No matter how big or small the occasion, Crust Pyrmont is your go-to pizza store in the Sydney CBD for office catering. Crust Pyrmont can deliver from 1 to 150 pizzas per order, using the best equipment to make sure your gourmet pizzas are delivered fresh, hot and on time. Choose between ordering online through the Crust Pizza app or simply call the store on 9566 1933. Crust Pizza Pyrmont proudly sponsors 2SER 107.3.
Amazing talent.
Live radio broadcasts.
Fantastic events.
You're on 2SER.
You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally through the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER.
A shout out to all our listeners around the country. To MIA Griffith, New South Wales, 2RRR Gladesville, New South Wales, 2 Wet Tank FM West Kempsey, New South Wales, 2XX FM Canberra City, 3CR Fitzroy, Victoria, 3UJ FM Alexandra, Victoria, 4NSA Queensland in Noosa Heads, 7RPH Hobart, Tasmania, 8CCC Alice Springs, 8EarGov FM in Nullanbee, ACT, 3CH in Wooden, Victoria.
And that's about all we have time for in this edition. We hope you enjoy the show.
Radio Atticus is broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER.
If you want more, why not tune into our podcasts on www.2ser.com/radioatticus.
Tune in again next week at the same time and place for your regular dose of justice and the law here on Radio Atticus. I'm Anna Marie Reyes.
And I'm Sophia Carvajal.